This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello, it is The Nolan Show with Holly Hamilton here once again. And we started the show today with something that we don't generally like to talk about. We're not good at talking about death, are we? Specifically in this instance, end-of-life care. And we were listening to Laura tell us her experience as a Marie Curie nurse, what it's like to go into someone's home as they're entering their final days, their final moments. How they provide support to family members and friends who are dealing with such an incredibly difficult moment in their lives, and the practicalities of that, just knowing what to expect, allowing the family members just to get a few hours sleep, having a cup of tea. And we did hear from Lisa, who lost her mum last year, and she told us just what it meant to her having that support physically and emotionally. I should say that there's a lot more information available to you online. We point to that during the show, just where you can find out more information to get more support. We were also talking about politics. It was all about the storm and brick, or really lack thereof, I should say, with two new EU regulations coming into force in Northern Ireland, without MLAs here having any say whatsoever. Has the system fallen at the first hurdle? And we asked, is it ever okay to call someone fat? Well, Mr. Motivator, you know, the one in the lycra off the telly, he thinks that people take criticism about their weight too personally, and that they complain all the time about being fat shamed instead. But is it as simple as that? I think the result of that conversation was no. A huge discussion and reaction on that, as you might imagine. And thank you. Thank you for having me here for the last couple of weeks. It's my last day. You can listen back to it all on BBC Sounds. Stephen will be back here on Monday. In the meantime, have a great weekend.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. It's Friday morning as well. It's Holly Hamilton here. It's my last day in the chair for a little while. So your last chance, or I should really say it's my last chance to speak to you for a while anyway, because it's been a privilege. It always is. So thank you very much. And we are starting this morning with a really difficult conversation, actually. It's one that we don't like to have at all. We're not very good at talking about death. Even though, if we're being honest with ourselves, I mean, it's something that we all have to deal with. And what we're talking about today, it's how we deal with it in a practical sense when it comes to end-of-life care. And I know a lot of people don't want to think about it, but when it does happen, end-of-life care can become such a vital service for so many people. However, according to the hospice care charity Marie Curie, more than a third of adults in the UK, that's over 20 million, have absolutely no idea what kind of help is on offer at the end of life. Now, for those who don't know, and I'm sure you do, Marie Curie is the UK's leading end-of-life charity. It provides hospice care, support for anyone with an illness and their families if they're likely to die from that illness. Such an important service. And I've been speaking to Laura Harland. Now, Laura is a Marie Curie nurse. She's based right here in Northern Ireland. And I also spoke to journalist Lisa Smith, who sadly lost her mum last year.
Well, as a Marie Curie nurse, we would enter, say, towards maybe the last year of a person's life, which would be called the palliative care, which it would be anyone with a life-limiting or incurable condition, such as motor neurone disease, dementia, heart failure or Parkinson's. So we would enter as early as that stage, and then more so towards the end of life, which is usually the last few days or hours of life.
And something we don't like to talk about is death. We don't like to think about it, which is understandable, but also what happens is it makes us almost completely unprepared for what actually happens in a physical and in an emotional sense, which I suppose is where you come in.
Indeed, it can be a very daunting experience for both the person themselves experiencing it and also the families or loved ones having to deal with the situation. So Marie Curie come in and we offer support, comfort and advice, and pretty much to have an experience of a good death.
People don't like to even refer to a good death. They don't like to admit to themselves that it's something that we'll all have to go through at some point. But from your point of view, Laura, what describe what that's like, you know, going into somebody's house where, I mean, anyone who's been affected by anything like this, you can almost feel the heaviness, the weight of emotions that people have when they're dealing with losing a loved one. How do you approach that? How do you alleviate that? Is it something that you're trained for? Is it instinctive? How do you know how to respond?
Absolutely. It can be a very troublesome time. And every household or home is different, so we just have to adjust to the situation and almost read the room, because everyone is an individual, and it can be a very stressful time. But we would go in and to try and offer a calming presence, is what I would say. It's an absolute privilege as a nurse to enter into someone's life at this time. It can be very physically and emotionally draining on everyone concerned. We try to treat everyone as an individual, and we believe that everyone deserves access to the specialist advice, comfort and support.
You
describe, at end of life.
You describe it as a privilege, but for the families that you've helped, I mean, I suppose they don't even realise the first moment they meet you that you're about to become one of the most important people in their lives.
Indeed. As I say, it's just making sure that we can give a sense of control if that's what's needed at that time. Sometimes it can be very distressing. Family or the person themselves can be quite distressed and agitated, or possibly having symptoms which are making the situation even more difficult. Anxiety, breathlessness, pain, nausea, agitation, and sometimes at the end of life we would often have like noisy chest secretions, and that can be very distressing, and as qualified nurses or our healthcare assistants also, we're able to identify those specific needs of the person at that time and do our best to alleviate those.
For anyone, I'm actually getting quite emotional, because I think that anyone who has experienced loss like this, just that, just somebody to make you feel safe, to make you feel like it's not scary, because a lot of it is terrifying. We have absolutely no idea in an emotional or physical sense what we're dealing with here. And having a voice like yours to come in and say, no, this is completely normal, is it means everything.
Yes, indeed. It's about just making sure that, you know, people understand what's happening, and you try and prepare them as best you can. But definitely bringing that calming influence and drawing emotion yourself from it also, you know, as a professional. It can become quite emotional. Sometimes it overwhelms me also. Yeah. You know, I'm a human being. I have those feelings also. It just, and it sometimes catches you as well. But to try and, you know, relate to the family in some way and just, as I say, alleviate any of their fears, concerns or those symptoms, and just giving a bit of advice and support.
How do you deal with that yourself then on a personal level? How do you feel in those moments where you start to feel emotional?
Well, I run with it. As I say, I'm only human. So if I feel tears coming, I will, you know, let them flow. But at the same time, I have to remember that I am the professional there, and I am there to support the family members or loved ones involved in this situation, and obviously the person themselves going through this, and I'm there to answer any questions. So I do try and keep my professional hat on, but at the same time, I'm personal also.
And you've been doing working as a nurse certainly for 22 years. You've worked in hospitals and in other elements within nursing. But what made you want to do this? What made you want to be a Marie Curie nurse?
Well, it spans right back to the start of my career when I remember caring for a person at the end of their life, and it was a very distressing time for the family, for the person themselves, and for myself. The symptoms were very poorly controlled at that time, and it's something I've never forgotten. Mm-hmm. So I, over my profession, I've gained a special interest in palliative and end of life care. I've had a personal experience of Marie Curie with relatives also, and they've been a great support, because even as a nurse, you know, when it's a family member of your own, it's a completely different circumstance, and you want someone to come in and take control of the situation and give you advice that you're nearly blinded by at that time. But I've had experience with palliative care for the most of my career in hospital, and more recently in the community, and I just always felt I wanted to help people. I want to help people. Obviously, I can't prevent someone at the end of life, but I want to be able to help them. I want to be able to comfort people. I have great peace within myself in terms of death, and I want to just to try and make it that bit easier for others that maybe find it that bit more difficult.
I suppose for the people that you're treating, it is such a different role as a nurse, because so much of what you do in healthcare is about trying to make people better. The job that you do, that's not a part of it. That moment has passed. And I imagine for those who are going through this, it's scary. It's terrifying. I wonder how you approach that, having those conversations.
That can be difficult as well, because sometimes, you know, the loved ones and the individual perhaps doesn't want to, you know, want to admit what's happening or accept what's happening. I think that's a big part of it, acceptance. And it's about, again, reading the room, trying to figure out, you know, and such this short period of time that we might, you know, meet these people, and trying to figure out how much they want to know, or how much they want to be protected from the situation, and that can be difficult at times. So we would try and use open-ended questions, and as the way I put it is try and make sure that we're all on the same page, you know, that when death does come, that it's not a massive shock that, you know, that can overwhelm to an extent. So that's what I want to try and, you know, make sure that people are comfortable, and that the family and loved ones are just that wee bit more comfortable in the situation.
You know, you talk about the fact that you experienced something yourself that made you want to do this, and it's a reaction that we see from a lot of people who have the care of Marie Curie nurses within their homes, and afterwards, you know, they either want to donate or just do something, because the help that was on offer, they genuinely feel that they couldn't have got through it without it, and they almost don't know how to thank you. They don't know how to express how grateful they are. They, you know, they use the term Marie Curie angels instead of nurses. We hear that time and time again. How does that make you feel?
Humbled, because I'm personally, I'm just being me, and just if my presence there can ease someone's burden just that little bit, that is more than enough for me. You know, definitely it's just being there as a comfort. And sometimes, you know, and being comfortable with silence as well. I mean, we don't always have to talk. Someone just being in the house at that time, spending the time. Like, we could be in maybe for half an hour, or we could be in for 3 or 4 hours, just depending on the situation and the circumstances. And having that time, it's special.
It's so true. It is. It's about embracing the silence in those moments. Listening to that is Lisa Smith. Lisa sadly lost her mum last year. Good morning, Lisa.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm good. First of all, Lisa, tell me about your mum.
So we lost my mum in August. She had dementia and she had COPD. So at the end, her lungs basically stopped working. And it all came about, I mean, we'd known for years that we were going to lose her. But she had rallied so many times in terms of her lungs that we almost kind of joked that we felt like she was indestructible. She went on for so many more years than any of us expected. But in the end, her condition became, you know, very, very, very bad very quickly, overnight. And that's when Marie Curie became involved with the family. And, you know, like you've just said, they are just angels.
And how aware were you beforehand of the work that they do? And as I mentioned earlier on, that this person who would be entering your home would become so important to you and throughout your process of grieving.
I mean, I'm aware of Marie Curie through my own work, so I know what they do. But I just, like I say, mum's condition deteriorated so quickly overnight. I woke up to a phone, like missed calls from my dad, and I rang him back, and he said, "Look, your mum's been really bad overnight. We had to get the doctor had to come out. She's very heavily sedated. He didn't think she was going to get through the night. He said that if she does get through the night, she's going to need a syringe driver. So, to be honest, I thought we'd had emergency situations before. So I drove up almost thinking that when I got there, mum was going to be sitting at the kitchen table up and. But when I got there, she was still very heavily sedated, and dad was waiting for the nurses to come and put in the syringe driver. And that's when it really hit that this was actually going to happen. So we waited for a few hours. The nurses arrived out, put in the syringe driver. And, you know, we'd never spoken to my mum about her death, about the fact that she was terminally ill. It was just something... we just never felt comfortable raising with her. Mm-hmm. My dad and I had spoken about it, and we knew that if possible, we would want her to be at home at the end. But we had no idea what that was going to look like. And I always remember when they put the driver in, and the district nurses, and we were chatting to them, and I started to ask just about practical things, you know, like personal care and
trying to think of things, as you say, the practicalities, while your emotions are, you know, you're overwhelmed at this point. I mean, I can't imagine how you're feeling, how you're trying to think straight in that situation.
Well, this is it, because you're processing the fact that I knew I was never going to, you know, speak to my mum again. I knew, you know, so I knew that we were going to lose her. I didn't know how soon it was going to happen, you know, what length of time it was going to take. But then you're thinking about the practical situation, like personal care. How do you look after someone who's on a syringe driver? You know, bed sores, keeping them hydrated, just all these types of things. I remember the district nurses saying, you know, well, a lot of families would do that themselves. And I became very distressed at that stage, because I've never felt, I felt we were so alone at that stage.
And it's such a huge responsibility to think that you have to, you know, be responsible for ensuring your own mother's comfort in those final days when you're grieving yourself.
Yeah, and that's when they said, well, look, we could refer you to Marie Curie. And that's how Marie Curie became involved. And for us, the service that they provided us, they came in. Now, they are very, very overstretched. So basically, you would get a phone call in the morning to tell you whether they were going to be able to come in and sit with Mum that evening.
Mm-hmm.
So the service that they provided for us was just a lifeline, because obviously when you've got someone at end of life, you just don't know when it's going to happen. There are so many unknowns. You don't know what it's going to be like. Is it going to be distressing? Are they going to be in pain?
Mm-hmm.
And we were obviously trying to keep Mum very sedated. So there was this fine balance, because basically her lungs had stopped working. So there were occasions when she would come around and it was so harrowing because she couldn't breathe.
We were just talking about that a little earlier on, because a lot of the physicality of this and what happens to the human body, we don't know about that. And it is absolutely terrifying when it happens, and just how important that is to have somebody who understands and can reassure you.
They can come in. They would come in the evening and they would sit with Mum, and it gave us an opportunity, because it is exhausting. Mm. You are physically and mentally exhausted. It gave us a chance to be able to go to bed and feel safe that somebody who really knew what they were doing was looking after Mum, and that they would come and get us if her condition took a turn for the worse. Because you're just so terrified to leave them in case something happens. So we didn't have them every night, just because they are so overstretched. And it was the Saturday night then that they didn't have anybody available. That was the first night, actually, where they didn't have anyone available. And my brother and I decided that we would take it in turns. He would sit with Mum till 3. I would come in at 3 in the morning and do the rest of the night. And when I came in at 3, I noticed that Mum's breathing had become, she was starting to become more agitated again.
Uh-huh.
And we made a call to phone the Marie Curie nurse. And you were like, these nurses, where my mum and dad live, like they have to come miles and miles and miles, you know, from the other side of the country almost to be there. And she arrived in, and she got Mum comfortable again. And we were just all, we were sitting around chatting, and all of a sudden she said, go and get your dad, get him now. She recognised that Mum was just about to go. And if she hadn't have been there, we wouldn't have known that. She recognised those signs, and we were able to get my dad into the room to be with Mum. We were all there at the end. And it was only because of her. And it was such a panic. It was so scary. But to have that person there with you who knows what's going on, is able to reassure you, was just. And afterwards, she was there with us. She was able to get Mum ready for the undertaker. You know, just all practical things like that that you just never consider when you say you want a loved one to be at home at the end.
Yeah, you don't think about what exactly it involves, and you've summed it up so well. You know, that those final moments are so important to a grieving family, to make sure that you are all there together in those moments. I mean, what did that mean for you? And you know, that moment that the Marie Curie nurse was able to tell you, this is it.
I mean, I will never, ever forget that lady. I will never, ever forget the moment. It's what she did for us. You know, you can never, ever thank those nurses for how they helped us through that week. It was, you know, the most awful week of my life. And they were just such a comfort. I remember when we were told they couldn't come that night, and it was so scary and upsetting, and thinking, oh gosh, how are we going to get through the night? And then obviously Mum's condition took a turn for the worse, and it's the Marie Curie nurses who come out whenever you have an emergency. They're the ones who come. They're the ones who administer the medication, who make sure that your loved one is comfortable and you know, as pain-free as possible. You know, and that woman, that nurse, she will never know. I will never be able to thank them enough for what they did for us.
Another word that I used at the time in my experience of a Marie Curie nurse was dignity. It was the dignity that they're able to give to your mother in those final moments.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even, you know, I told you that she was with us afterwards, so she was able to get Mum ready for the undertaker, you know, and I wanted to be able to help her, but I just couldn't in that moment, you know, and the fact that she was able to give my mum that dignity before the undertakers arrived, even, mm-hmm. you know, just means so much to me. She's just such a special lady, you know. The work that they do is just the most incredible, incredible work, and they just don't get enough recognition. You couldn't give them enough recognition for what they do.
It is interesting that people don't quite realise. Unfortunately, the only way you'll ever realise the work that they do is when you're going through something like this. You don't understand it until you're experiencing it. And I think that's why it's so important we're having this conversation, because unfortunately it comes to all of us. And I think there's also a misconception that Marie Curie is only available to cancer patients, for example, but that's not the case, is it?
Yeah, well, exactly. And my mum didn't have cancer, you know, COPD and end-stage lung failure and dementia. So, and there was no question. I mean, we obviously didn't even realise it was a possibility. It was only the fact that the district nurse happened to mention it to us whenever they fitted the driver. And we said, yes, do you think that would be possible? And then the next thing, we had a phone call from Marie Curie, and they were sending someone to sit with us that night. Well, I don't know. They couldn't come the first night. That's right. They couldn't come the first night, uh-huh. but they sat with Mum every night then through that week. And then the Saturday night was the next night that they couldn't come. But fortunately, the way things worked out, I'm just so glad that we made that phone call, and we had a Marie Curie nurse at the time that we did, because I know that my brother and I would have been terrifying to go through that without somebody with us.
Lisa, thank you for sharing your story, and I know that there will be a lot of people listening to this who will relate to so much of what you had to say, and Laura, who was listening to that. Laura, we talked about the dignity, and you know, the idea that a Marie Curie nurse is a safety net for people who are going through something like this. Another element, and I'm not sure, Lisa, if you experienced this, there was a sense of, I don't want to say normality, but there's an ability to be able to have a stranger, in a way, in the room, you know, where you're offering somebody a tea and a coffee, going through the motions of that a little bit, and unable to tell stories about this person who is at the centre of all this, being able to share funny stories and almost be able to have a laugh and bring a little bit of light into the room. Do you find that people share an awful lot with you, and you learn an awful lot about the people that you're caring for?
Oh, that's one of the best parts. It definitely is. Because at the time that we're going in to see the person at the end of their life, we're only seeing that part of yeah. their life. So I would always make a point of looking at photographs and certainly even, you know, if it's appropriate, you know, delving into that personal element, just that wee bit more to find out who that person was and what their interests were. And that, again, I'll use the word, is a privilege at that time to just delve into that history a bit. But no, I very much, again, it's on a time scale. So we could be in for a very short space of time, but you'll build up a relationship. Mm-hmm. Not all the time now, you know, there are times when it doesn't happen, but I would try and build a relationship just to make it that bit more personal.
And it's one of the parts of, you know, it's such a sad time in for anybody having to deal with the death of a loved one. But there is an element of a celebration of their life. And, you know, for you to be able to listen to those stories. And I think having a bit of joy and laughter in that moment is so, so important.
Indeed. If it's appropriate, you know, and yeah, but absolutely. If I can bring a smile, you know, obviously we go in, I would introduce myself and I would ask, you know, what the person wants to be called. And I would find out who is in the room with me. Is it a relative? Is it a caregiver? You know, is it a close friend? I like to know who's in the room and who, you know, who is around this person at this, you know, significant time. Mm-hmm. And then that generates the conversation after that.
Lisa, I'm not sure if you keep in touch with any of the nurses that you dealt with, and I know you speak so highly of them. And it's interesting, the term we mentioned earlier on, we talk about them as angels, the Marie Curie angels, and I'm sure it's a phrasing that you've used over the last few months.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, actually, when we had a number of different people, and the lady who was with us whenever Mum died, she was in a number of times. And, you know, you do get to know them. It is very, very strange. I remember the first night we had someone coming in to sit with Mum, and I found it really, really weird. You just feel really, this is someone you've never met before. And when you've never been in this situation before, yeah, you've got a complete stranger coming into your house. But actually, the lady we had in on the first night, and she was only in with us once, I actually ended up sitting in with her for about 2 hours, just talking and laughing and getting to know about her and talking about my mum and talking about my family. You know, I should have been in bed sleeping, but I found her a real comfort. She was such a lovely lady. And interestingly as well, she was caring for her six family members, and she had got into Marie Curie because she had nursed a sick family member at end of life. And, you know, they were really just, they're so easy to talk to and so comforting. And you do have light moments where you're laughing and that you need that, I think, whenever you're going through all of this.
Yeah, completely. As I said, it's a sense of, I don't want to say normality because none of it is normal, but just that, like I say, making a tea and having a chat with somebody, just it sort of lifts, it just lifts you that little bit as much as you can in those final moments.
Yeah, and actually one thing that I haven't said that I should say is, the lady that was in with us when Mum died, and she did everything. I mean, she was absolutely incredible. And when she left us, so she was with us, say from about 3 a.m. till about 5 a.m. When she left us, she went out and got into her car and drove on to the next family with a loved one at end of life. You know, to think that she has gone from that, from such a profound moment, and being involved and seeing our grief and being there for us, in a way that I can never put into words what she did, to then just get into a car and drive on to another house going through the exact same thing and doing the same things for them. It's just incredible.
What would you say to her now if she was listening?
I there's nothing I could say to let her know just how wonderful she is and how special she is. And she is somebody I will never, ever forget. I will never, ever forget her for the rest of my life. You know, she was there at one of a defining moment in my life, losing my mummy. She was there. She made that easier for me. One of the worst moments, you know, losing a parent, it's horrible. She's just incredible. I don't have words to express how grateful I am.
Well, I hope she is listening wherever she is, and to any of the Marie Curie nurses who do work hard right across Northern Ireland and beyond. Thank you, Lisa, for sharing your story. again, I think there'll be so many people listening to this who will understand exactly what you've been through. And Laura Harland, who is a Marie Curie nurse based here in Northern Ireland, thank you for sharing your experiences and your story with us this morning. So great.
Thank you.
So grateful that they were able to tell us their stories and give us that little bit of insight. Because anyone listening to this who's been through it will understand every word that was said. And for other people, you know, it might just give you that little bit of information that you didn't know you needed, I suppose. We've had some calls and texts on this. Let's speak to Peter in Guildford. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning.
Were you listening there? What did you make of that? How much did you know about the work that Marie Curie does?
Well, I tell you what, that woman is telling the whole truth. I can relate to all that because my wife died with bone cancer last year.
I'm so sorry,
but
Peter.
for a few months before that, I'd be on my own all night or all night, and I'd have to call them in sometimes. They say I didn't get a wink of sleep maybe for 4 or 5 nights, and maybe an hour here and an hour there, she'd be waking up like in pain, and I was doing all the tablets and medicine and all that, and you know, Oramorph and all, you know, for to keep the pain away. And it'd be nice to be.
It's a lot to have to deal with by yourself.
It's unbelievable, but it's wonderful that the way the strength you get. Like I could have done it for 10 more years to get to go straight, but you get great strength, but you'd be. There's nights you'd be wore out completely and days like you wouldn't. You had that many visitors in the daytime, you couldn't get a bit of sleep. You know what I mean, coming in. But anyway, it was great to see them. And I had good help in the daytime, but at night time it was awkward. And I'd have to call in Marie Curie. And they were wonderful women, there was no doubt about it. As that woman said, I never met them in my life, but they were just good people and they could talk like... I could relate to that woman talking there to talk to me as well. You know, before I go to bed at night, instead of going on to bed, I'd stay for a half an hour, even though it was completely wore out. But as soon as I knew they were in the room or around, I'd go to bed and I'd sleep in about 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And right the morning, I'd be top set for 10 minutes before they leave. Like, I'd like to go up and talk to them before they leave and how my wife got on. And that's the way it was, like. Went on like that till she went into the hospice, right? It's only give her a couple of days to live in the hospice in Newry, but they were that wonderful in Newry. She'd come home after 3 weeks and lived 10 more weeks at home at Millet. And it was the same, went through the same, but and at hospital bed in that time. And I'd marry Curie coming now and again. Like I'd have to ring them, like, and they'd ring me back. And I'd get them maybe a night a week, one night a week, sometimes 2 nights a week.
And that's all it takes sometimes, just to give you that bit of strength.
Get their strength back again. But they're the best people, and so calm and collected, and come from all over the country. Like, they could be coming away down from Tyrone, maybe way up the Acadia direction, Wearns Town. I forget where nearly all of them came from. I've forgotten all that now. But they were the good hearted people, and that's what we need in this world.
That's it. And as I mentioned earlier, it's the not realising that this total stranger will make such an important part in your life.
To get a good night's sleep when you're not getting any sleep at all. You're raising every half hour, every... I had a wee camera, and in the end I had I propped up a chair beside the bed, and you know what I mean, coming near the end I would prop up a chair and prop up it with a coffee table and 5 or 6 pillows on it and try and doze off myself. But then I used to have a dish of water beside the bed with a dishcloth in it, it's cooler down, you know, dip it, and a fan going and many other things to try and keep temperatures down, you know what I mean?
Oh, Peter, thank you for coming on and sharing your story. As you say, I think what you've had to say and what Lisa's told us, it speaks to so many people. So thank you for your call on that, Peter. And let's speak to Sean in Enniskillen. Good morning, Sean.
Holly, that was a brilliant programme.
you presented it exceptionally well.
Oh, I did very little. I did very little. As I say, the story is incredible.
It's your voice. It's the way you tell it. But the one word that sticks out for me is charity. Mm. Why does this have to be a charity? Death is a part of life. It's a part of living. And you really, I can't get over it, really. You did such a good job.
Oh, well, as I say, I did very little.
Very understanding in your voice.
It's just the work that they do. I think it's just the bare facts of it. And it's just listening to what it is that they do, these nurses, and the difference that it makes to people's lives. As I say, and anyone who's been affected by this, they understand fully. And for anyone who wants to get more information on this, just head over to the Marie Curie website. All the information is there, mariecurie.org.uk. There's a phone number here in Northern Ireland, 0800 716 146. And there are a whole range of incredible charities that can help you if you need some information or support for yourself or someone you know who's been affected by bereavement or end of life care. Just head over to bbc.co.uk/actionline. Okay, it's approaching 9:45 now, and let's head into some politics, shall we? Just to lighten the mood somewhat. Now, the unionists here have blasted the UK government after they say the new stormont break has fallen down at the first hurdle. This comes as two new EU regulations have come into force in Northern Ireland without MLAs having any say on it whatsoever. Just to set this out, our political editor, Enda McClafferty, has been telling me exactly what happened.
Well, this came as a surprise to us yesterday, Holly, whenever the Windsor Framework Scrutiny Committee met at Stormont. And the first item of business was this talk of this letter that didn't arrive in time for the Scrutiny Committee to consider two new pieces of EU regulations. And as a result, those regulations are now in force. And the deadline for having an inquiry around them, applying the Stormont break to suspend them, has now passed because of the delay. And it has left the committee in an impossible position, whereby the clock has essentially run out and there's nothing they can do about these two pieces of environmental legislation. Now, that, as you can imagine, caused a lot of anger among committee members yesterday. The fact that the Cabinet Office was aware about the publication of this legislation in February the 20th to be exact, but didn't notify officially the MLAs at Stormont until earlier this month, a gap of some 8 weeks, and that left them in this impossible position. And that's where we got a lot of the frustration being echoed yesterday, some of them saying, for instance, that if this system's only up and running a matter of weeks and already it seems to have fallen apart at the seams because of the lack of, I suppose, movement by the Cabinet Office to deal with things the way they should deal with things. So it is a peculiar situation, and if this is the first test of how these new systems are going to work, it is pretty clear from what MLA said yesterday, it has failed.
Yeah, so as you've set out, the laws have already come into force. Nothing can be changed there. But why is this so significant? Have promises been broken here?
Well, not so much promises as a system has been broken, because timing is everything when it comes to the Windsor Framework Scrutiny Committee, because they only have a set period of time. Once a piece of EU regulation is published, they then have a matter of, I think, 5 to 6 weeks to be able to hold an inquiry to assess whether or not it's not going to work in Northern Ireland, essentially, and then for perhaps unionists to go off and trigger the storm and break to try and prevent this application in Northern Ireland. So they have to do that all within 6 weeks. So it's crucial that the first piece of that jigsaw falls into place in time, and that is notification from the Cabinet Office. That didn't happen this time. The Cabinet Office didn't contact the committee until 8 weeks later, and that left them then in this predicament yesterday. Now, the Cabinet Office, I think, seemed to be suggesting to the members, now we didn't get sight of the correspondence, but judging what the members had to say yesterday, the Cabinet Office seemed to suggest that this was no big deal because we're dealing with two pieces of environment legislation, one talking about F-gases and reducing their use in the manufacture of refrigeration systems, and the other talked about reducing the use of ozone-depleting substances in Northern Ireland. And the government's argument, I think, to members was, look, this is already more or less in place. This was never going to be controversial. So therefore, there's no need to create any kind of fuss around all of this. It was a simple mistake. It's not going to happen again. But for the members of the committee yesterday, this was a dangerous precedent. The fact that in their eyes that the Cabinet Office took their eye off the ball in this, that it wasn't high enough the priority list. And had this been two pieces of legislation which is going to prove contentious, it rendered, as one committee member said yesterday, them impotent in terms of being able to deal with it in the appropriate way.
When we consider all the talk we had around this, how much we went into what exactly, how the Stormont break functions, how it will operate, and here we are, the first bit of legislation here, and well, we don't even get to talk about it. We don't even get to have a go. I mean, is Westminster sort of tone deaf on this when they say that there's no need to make any fuss around this?
Well, I think they're going to get the message loud and clear that there is a need to make a fuss around everything that comes Northern Ireland's way by way of EU regulation. I think that's going to be made clear in the letter now that MLAs are going to send back to the Cabinet Office. And I know there's a desire as well to raise it with the UK-EU Joint Committee, which effectively oversees the running of the Windsor framework. So there is a message going to be delivered on this, that they just cannot take their eye off the ball at any stage, because if this system breaks down at first base, so to speak, then there's nothing that MLAs can do in Northern Ireland when it comes to dealing with legislation coming its way. And there was a sense around trust as well raised yesterday, that can MLAs trust the Cabinet Office to keep its eye on the ball to ensure that everything falls into place? Well, the example of this week would suggest not. And that's why there's a lot of dissatisfaction among members of this committee yesterday at how far down the priority list it appears this issue around dealing with EU regulation in Northern Ireland appears to be on the surface, judging by the example of what happened this week.
And just while I have you got your calculator handy, as I mentioned, Casement Park? A lot of talk around this over the last sort of 24 hours again, but I mean, we're no further on, really, is the crux of it.
Well, no further on, apart from listening to Michelle O'Neill, the First Minister, emerging from the meeting yesterday, saying that Chris Heaton-Harris told her that there's announcement imminent. We don't know what that means. There was no timeline provided anywhere. We know from Gordon Lyons yesterday that he's seeking clarity as to the funding package, who's going to stump up when it comes to the big gap in funding that's now required to allow the Casement redevelopment to go forward. We had Jarlath Burns, the President of the GAA, earlier this week talking about something going to happen within the course of the next week or so. We don't really know if that's going to be the case, because there's silence when it comes to the NIO around all of this, and the government as well, because they're obviously making calculations behind the scenes as to how they're going to deal with this, because as the GAA president made clear this week that they've given a written commitment and a letter that they're going to come up with the rest of the funding. So the government has to sort of state its position, because we know that there was some reluctance around Treasury, the fact that there's weren't prepared to write a blank cheque around this rising cost around the stadium. So there's lots of different moving parts around all of this, and at some stage, Holly, they're going to have to come to a head, because the clock is running out in terms of redeveloping this stadium if it is to be redeveloped in time for the Euros in 2028.
Enda McLafferty, thank you for your that as always. Well, let's speak now to TUV leader Jim Allister, who's on the line. Good morning to you, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning. We've also got Alliance MP Stephen Farry. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, Holly.
And also Unionist Committee member Steve Aiken. Morning to you.
Good morning, everybody.
It's like a roll call. Love it. Right. Look, let's start first of all, the Stormont break, Jim, if only by name.
Yes, and shown up to be wholly inadequate. The source of the problem here is the regulations which set up the Stormont break. They were ironically called the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Regulations of 2023. And instead of imposing a mandatory obligation on the British government to inform Stormont of new EU laws, Regulation 6 is cast in terms of the committee may be notified of replacement EU acts by the government. So obviously it's a discretion, it's not mandatory, it should have said shall, and that of course is the flawed system which the DUP accepted when they came forward with the Donaldson deal. So they are now hoisted on the petard of having accepted an inadequate system, leading to a position quite incredible, where we're not only ruled by laws we don't make, but now by laws we don't even know about. How much more undemocratic, how much more colonial can it get?
Steve,
than to be ruled by laws you don't even know about?
Steve, just on that then, is this just the wording is wrong? The UK government here is going, well, we don't actually have to tell you this. It's only if we want to.
Which Stephen?
Steve Aiken. Oh, sorry. I
all
Stephen,
right, okay.
Stephen
that
and
always
Steve.
Happens when I'm on with Stephen Farry.
All right, Steve Aiken, you go ahead.
Here, the problem is very significant because we only have 5 days for which, if we have notification, to decide whether we're going to have an inquiry or not. And one of the things we've noticed is that just in case a mistake is made, either by the European Union, the Cabinet Office, or heaven forbid, even ourselves, there's nothing in the legislative process to allow us to extend that in exceptional circumstances. It's not. It's something that needs to be dealt with.
Were these exceptional circumstances?
Yes, they are exceptional circumstances because we do not know. Look, I've got a doctorate in international relations. I have no idea what the impact on helium gases will be or whether it's going to affect the Northern Ireland economy in any particular way. What we would have been doing, and this is the thing that all of the committee, and that means from all the political parties, DUP, ourselves, Alliance and Sinn Féin, all of us felt very uncomfortable that we didn't know what was going on and we didn't have any of the advice and guidance from the departments or any experts that we could have looked at. Because, quite frankly, I think most people will take what may come from the Cabinet Office or indeed from some levels of officialdom with a pinch of salt, because we need to actually find out for ourselves. There may not have been an issue, but indeed there are questions that need to be asked about whether some of the things that were being raised would have an impact. Now, I can't go into all the information that we were given in closed session, but there's sufficient there for us to consider. We would probably have wanted to at least have held an inquiry to understand what was going on. And we failed at the first hurdle.
But if that's true, if what Jim's saying is true, that it says that they may go through the motions with this, not that they will, then surely this is something that should have been addressed before going back into Stormont again.
Well, indeed, it's something I raised on Sunday and Monday because I was at the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly. And there were discussions both with the new Taoiseach and also with senior officials on both the UK and the Irish side. Uh-huh. And the conversation was, one of the main conversations was about how was, because they knew I sit on the Windsor Framework Committee, how it was working. And I said there are significant problems that are likely to arise because there isn't enough communication and flexibility within the system. So one of the things the Joint Committee should be looking at right now is A, to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And B, if it does happen, there needs to be sufficient flexibility within the system where we can deal with that. Because quite frankly, the people of Northern Ireland don't want us to go from one crisis to another over the storm and break every couple of weeks. Mm. And the way to do that is to make sure that we're making the system work effectively. And, you know, it's, you know, the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee, you know, you will have already heard from what I've said in the Assembly with member statements and the rest of it. Yeah. I've encouraged the committee to actually be a bit more proactive. But when we are being proactive and then being undermined by the fact we're not getting the information, that should be a concern to everybody in Northern Ireland.
Well, Alliance MP Stephen Farry, do you feel that this should be a priority then? Is this, I mean, how much of a problem is this going to be? How much of a priority should it be?
Well, I mean, it is a problem, and clearly the UK government messed up on this particular occasion.
But did they? Did they mess up, or was it just the fact that the wording is wrong? They didn't actually have to.
Well,
they
should have communicated, but I think, Holly, this points to a much bigger issue here. The storm and break and also the applicability motions concepts are all about the Assembly acting at the end of the sausage-making process, and it's either a yes or a no situation. That's essentially flawed. I mean, the Assembly itself needs its own early warning system whenever a new EU law is coming through or updated EU law. And rather than simply relying upon the UK government, I mean, we need to be talking about a bigger Northern Ireland presence in Brussels to hear ourselves directly whenever things are coming through at an early process. And even more importantly, if there are concerns concerns about how something may impact upon Northern Ireland, then we get in early and make those concerns felt. Because it's simply coming in at the end of the process and going through the motions of scrutiny and then either having to say yes or no is missing the fundamental point. And if you look at other jurisdictions that are outside the European Union official structures but still part of the wider network, such as Norway, Iceland, Liechtenstein, they all have very strong offices in Brussels, and they get in and lobby the Commission at the early stages. And that's the missing part of this equation here, which where the discussion really needs to go.
So, Jim, is that the problem then? The fact that we're actually not attending the parties that we should be invited to, and because we're not getting to go, then we're not finding out the information that we would have had if we'd had a presence in Brussels?
No, the problem is a protocol which subjects Northern Ireland to foreign laws we don't make and can't change and I don't even know about. That's the problem.
But what if we went above its head?
Sorry?
If we go above its head, Stephen
yes,
says.
I'm addressing the fundamental principle. Why is this part of the United Kingdom subject to laws we don't make, subject now to laws we don't even know about? The rest is just sticking plaster in terms of trying to make that better, but not addressing the fundamental obscenity that you're governed by laws you don't make and now don't even know about.
Stephen Farrey, on that.
And that's the fundamental of the protocol.
Stephen,
whenever we were part of the European Union, we had our MEPs, we had the UK Prime Rep, we had Northern Ireland ministers able to engage with that process. So the system worked, and obviously Brexit has happened, and we're in a flawed situation now where we're trying to make the best of it. So it can be improved. We made more fluid if we can get in earlier in the process, and that's really where we need to put the attention.
Alliance of Stephen Farrey, TV leader Jim Allister and Ulster Unionist Committee member Steve Aiken, thank you very much for your time on that this morning. Is it ever okay to tell someone that they're fat? Well, Mr. Motivator, you know the one in Lycra? Yeah, the TV fitness guru that you might see telling you to put you through your paces during the 90s. Well, he has said that people take criticism about their weight too personally and complain that they have been fat-shamed. The fitness fanatic said when he was on TV, you could prod someone's belly and tell them they needed to shape up. Now, in the body positivity era, everyone believes they have the right to be any size you want to be. Well, I spoke about this earlier to commentator and Irish Mirror columnist Siobhan O'Connor and commentator Emma Wolfe, and I began by asking Siobhan just what she made of the comments from Mr. Motivator and if she was motivated by them.
That's the problem. I think when we hear the word fat, we have, it's almost like the term if somebody has a problem with alcohol, alcoholic. We almost assume that the problem is with the person and not the societal issues going beyond what the problem is. And I think we need to reframe Mr. Motivator's speak. I think there's a lot of problems with the body positivity movement because it's glorifying health problems. If you're obese, which is clinically 30, over 30, if you've got a BMI of over 30, mm-hmm. you're clinically obese, which actually, I trained as a personal trainer and I had to assess my family and my friends. And some of my friends who didn't look big, for instance, like, you know, on the outside, when I tested them, they were clinically obese. So the problem is we have to reframe health. And I think calling people fat is kind of shocking to us. Mm. But actually, the issue is if we go on like, oh, your body beautiful, don't worry about it. Of course, size doesn't matter aesthetically, but it's what's happening with our internal organs. And we need to help people and reframe the whole thing to make them, I suppose, adopt healthier living patterns. And obesity as well is so complex. If you're not getting enough sleep, if you're, you know, if your whole kind of lifestyle isn't involving a fitness regime, it doesn't need to be, you know, weight training, it can be walking. If your lifestyle isn't conducive to helping your body, you're going to end up being dubbed the word fat, which Mr. Motivator could have gone about it a better way, but I think we do need to reframe it.
So Emma, it's true. Words are important. That is the bottom line here. But there is an element to this of how do we tell people that they are overweight? You know, what is the right language to use?
Well, let's be clear. First of all, no one should be prodding anyone else in the belly fat or not. So Mr. Motivator needs to stop all that about prod them in the belly and tell them they're fat. I agree with a lot of what Siobhan said in terms of honesty. I think we need to be honest with people. I think we need to be braver. When I say we, I mean the NHS. I mean that doctors need to be honest, but we don't need to be brutal. Mm. Okay, this is very personal and it's extremely sensitive. Weight is very, very sensitive. And it's not even about the sensitivity. It's what works, what is effective. If you fat shame people, if you skinny shame people, it's not kind, but it's not effective. It's not productive of what we want, which is to get everybody to a healthy weight. If you shame people about being fat and using the word fat to their face, maybe overweight is better, maybe obese is better, but if you shame them, they will just retreat further into their shell. For years and years, I was skinny shamed, which is the other end of the spectrum, and I was actually unwell. I actually had anorexia. The mm-hmm. point is, weight is an incredibly personal thing. We just hear today in the news that Brits are now eating 50% more calories from takeaway food. So there is no question that we have a major crisis. Obesity is actually the biggest killer in the NHS. When we talk about the NHS, the problem with the NHS is basically obesity, stroke, heart, all the things that lead from obesity. So yes, we need to talk about it. We need to help people get back to a healthy weight. And that is not only being more active, but also eating more healthy food and eating fewer calories. But it is not about, you know, what Mr. Motivator says is basically shame people into it. No, it's about sensitivity, but honesty, being honest with people.
Yeah, it's tricky because I feel like we're at this point too, because there's two things here. We're obviously living within an obesity pandemic, obviously, but we also have this generation who grew up, particularly women, and I talk about this as a woman, who grew up in an era where the adverts on TV were encouraging women to live on cereal. Yep. Certain diets, to live on milkshakes, that, you know, there were magazines that showed perfectly fit women and calling them fat. So I suppose, Siobhan, then it's difficult to try and marry the two together, how we improve people's health while kind of dealing with the mental health of people who kind of grew up in a really awful, awful time.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head there, Holly, because the mental issues are correlated with the lifestyle factors.
Mm.
So if you're not feeling good inside, you're going to reach for that ultra-processed food. There's a fabulous book, and if anyone doesn't have the time to read it, you can get it on Audible. I'm not promoting it, but I just got it myself. Chris Van Tulleken, Ultra-Processed People. And it's all about how the big companies who sell us all this, as Emma said there, all the rubbishy cereals, filled with sugar, filled with added ingredients that aren't even foodstuffs. Like, if you look at the back of the packet, the kind of the bottom line is, go into a supermarket, check the back of the packet, and if you don't recognise any of those ingredients as food, like they're not in your store cupboard at home, they're ultra processed. And if you can just get your head around the fact that if you can just eat whole foods to start with and add a little bit of exercise in, like walking or anything you can do that kind of moves your body and moves your body away from the stimulus of the food that's affecting your weight. It's obviously multifactorial and far more complex than just food. But the ultra-processed food is enemy number one. And that's what's keeping people trapped in the cycle as well. It's obviously a lot more complex. But mental health, if you're feeling bad inside, of course you're going to reach for that ultra-processed quick thing. You're hardly going to sit there and knock up a whole foods recipe if you're feeling bad inside. And then having Mr. Motivator calling you fat isn't going to help the situation either. But maybe addressing, well, if you add a little bit of walking in first and then, you know, eat something more healthy. But you need to be educated on what is more healthy. And we're thinking, we're going for those things in the shop that say healthy on them. And by and large, a lot of those things aren't healthy and they've been marketed to us in the wrong way. So that has to change as well. And that does have to start at the top. Governments are keeping us trapped as well.
Emma, go ahead. Because I think this is a really interesting point, that so much of, certainly kind of in the early noughties and the 90s and that sort of thing, the focus was on trying not to be fat. It was trying to get away from being a certain body shape rather than the positivity, i.e. eating healthily, eating clean, you know, getting away from toxic food and that sort of thing. Should the focus then be more on that sort of language? And should that be a concern?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And the big food manufacturers are incredibly clever. They've got to a point where they fill these products with salt and fat and sugar. So it's more, more, more-ish. And so, for example, you have a McDonald's or, you know, any other kind of fast food. You feel full for about half an hour, and then you're immediately back in that craving cycle of needing more fat, more sugar, more salt. So they're very, very clever. We literally have ready meals, which are never healthy. I mean, they are full of processed food, ultra-processed ingredients.
And there are a lot of kind called, of, inverted commas, low-fat ready meals.
And they're called that things like healthy living. There are labels that I'm looking at right now. They're literally called things like that. But also we live in an obesogenic society. And Holly, your point about the women who were literally brought up, like our mothers, our grandmothers, us, literally brought up permanently on diets. That is a kind of side issue and led to things like anorexia and all the kind of eating disorders that is sort of my, you know, that my background. So I think that too is a huge problem. But right now we live in an obesogenic society where everything is geared. It's like a perfect storm. Everything is geared towards less movement because we have cars, we have phones, we have deliveroos, we have takeaways. We have everything geared towards less movement and greater consumption. You know, children are basically in, you know, they don't play out. They can't play outdoors as much. Mm. People in lockdown didn't move as much. So it's kind of, it's the direction of travel for the human race or, you know, people is really, really dangerous because we're not doing the physical labor. Do you think in the old days, women would be, yes, they'd be eating bread and dripping and lard and chips and potatoes, all the good. No, they would, but they were doing hard physical labor. Mm-hmm. Men were working in factories and down the mines. We didn't have heating in our homes. We had to do the washing by hand. All of that hard physical labor is gone. You just press the button on the washing machine. You just order an Uber. You know, there's no, the balance has gone completely out of whack. So even if you're not overeating, it's very, very hard to stay slim in a world where you're being constantly bombarded with snacks and smoothies and have another coffee and have another latte and. It's tough.
That's the problem, isn't it? Because you've hit the nail on the head with the perfect storm. You know, we're living in this era where everybody, the obesity's growing, but we obviously have to be body positive. But I always envisage this, the film WALL-E. I don't know if you've seen it, where the humans live in space and they're all too obese to move because, as you say, everything, you just hit a button and food arrives. And every time I use any of these apps, I do feel a little bit like that the food is just brought to me. So how do we avoid this WALL-E existence? You know, how do we avoid us just being constantly body positive and, you know, trying to avoid the idea of calling each other fat and these awful loaded terminology that we're trying not to use, but then at the same time, how do we find a healthy lifestyle in the midst of all this? Or, as Emma put it, are we just in this perfect storm, Siobhan?
Well, I think Emma is so right what she says, and I love the way she speaks, and I think, you know, the first key is movement. If GPs prescribed movement first as opposed to SSRIs before they even get us a clinical analysis, a lot of like GPs are fabulous, but they aren't trained in a lot of areas which could be, and this is a bit controversial, but if you look at the clinical analysis required to get a mental health order, you know, even analyzed, you would need extreme tests. Not just a quick, oh, take an antidepressant. And we're keeping people trapped in a cycle of feeling bad about themselves by just, you know, pop a pill, have a relaxing glass of wine and, you know, eat a nice processed food bun in the shop. Like, as opposed to seeing, well, what's at the core of this? Why is this person unhappy? And I think you can't just say prescribe exercise. But if people, as Emma said, moved more like our ancestors, and maybe Mr. Motivator could maybe motivate people who are bigger to move instead of calling them fat first. Because if you're moving more, you tend to be focused kind of introspectively on what your body is saying and doing and feeling to yourself. Therefore, you will kind of educate yourself on the healthier eating choices. But if you're not moving first, you've no impetus to go and find what the good food is to eat. And when you go into the supermarket, girls, I don't know if you notice it with young kids as well, we're bombarded with all the rubbish first before we even hit the vegetables.
It's the most accessible.
And also exercise, especially outdoors. And I just mean walking around the park is the biggest endorphin rush ever. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you're outdoors, a wonderful, and I promise I'll stop now, but a wonderful dietitian said 6 words, move more, eat less, mostly green. And I thought, isn't that brilliant? If you make sure that most of your food is fresh, move more, eat less, mostly green. It's a good rule of thumb. I know it's not always easy and it's not simple, but it's a good way to live.
Well, I think we do a better job, to be honest with you, of motivating than the Mr. Motivator himself.
Yeah.
Siobhan O'Connor and Emma Wolfe, thanks very much for your time on this morning. Great to chat to you.
Thanks, ladies.
Well, lots of you getting in touch on this morning. Mary's texting to say people really need to keep their opinions to themselves. I've lost weight and been shamed for losing weight, not gaining it. Anonymous says women do not want to be called fat. The word they hear is ugly. John says, what is fat? My mother was a robust country woman. When she was diagnosed with cancer, the doctor said, thank goodness you have a bit of meat on you. It's the stick insects that come in here. I can't do anything for them. Lots of different opinions. Haley's on the line. Good morning, Haley.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a wee point. Sometimes it's not about diet and exercise. I have a condition called lipedema. It's different to lymphedema.
Uh-huh.
So it's basically, and it affects approximately 11% of the population. So the fat deposits evenly on the bottom half of your body. It doesn't respond to diet and exercise.
Yeah.
It's a hormone-related issue, so it occurs during puberty, pregnancy, menopause. It can be controlled to a point if diagnosed early, but most people aren't diagnosed early. It's different to obesity. So I do Pilates twice a week, and I weight train once a week. Uh-huh. I eat healthily. I've had to have surgery to remove some of this fat. It doesn't come back.
You say 11% of women across the world have this.
Yeah.
Lipedema, it's called.
There is 11% of the population will have this condition, not know about it, and will be called obese. And they aren't obese. It's fat that will not move. Whether or not you eat lettuce mm-hmm. and go to the gym 5 days a week, it will not move. You will lose the fat that you have on your body, but lipedemic fat will not shift. And it's not provided, the treatment's not provided on the NHS.
It's a really important thing to mention, Hayley, and thank you for calling in about this, because we do talk so much about, you know, losing weight and how we address this, when actually for a lot of people it is beyond that there are medical reasons for people being different sizes and shapes and all sorts of things. And it's really, that's a huge part of it. You know, this idea of Mr. Motivator telling people that they need to kind of own up to their bodies and, you know, just to be told that they're fat, that's not really helpful, is it?
No, it's not. Absolutely not. I mean, I know myself doing Pilates and weight training. It helps me and it keeps me mobile. Now, my mobility will increasingly get worse due to the condition. And the only thing I can do is save up and get the operations. Otherwise, I'm going to cost the health service a lot of money in the future for something that I can do nothing about.
No, well, thank you, Hayley, for raising that point. And it's interesting, the amount of women in particular who are talking about this morning. You do wonder, is there a tendency for this sort of language to be pointed in their direction? Thank you for all your texts and calls on that this morning. It is 23 minutes past 10 and we are going to be staying with health, because it is such an important issue right now. We talk so much about waiting lists, and yesterday we were talking about how difficult it is to get an appointment with your GP, and now burnt out and stressed out is what the Stormont's Health Committee heard Royal College of Surgeons Director Niall McGonigal say yesterday. Surgeons are not getting enough time in theatres to carry out the scale of elective operations that are required. Lack of staffing means theatres not being commissioned, and some theatres being used for other medical patients or trauma cases. The committee was told that this is having a detrimental impact, with surgeons and their teams being burnt out, stressed out and straining to get access to theatres. I'm joined now by Niall McGonigal, the Director of the Royal College of Surgeons in Northern Ireland. Good morning, Niall.
Good morning, Holly.
It's strong language to talk about being burnt out and stressed out, but it is a message that we do seem to be hearing right across the health board.
Absolutely. And I think sort of the evidence being provided to the health committee at Stormont within the last couple of weeks by several of the Royal Colleges points to these exact same points, that we have a workforce that has come out of a major crisis, a pandemic of COVID. It's into massive waiting lists, massive pressures on the health service, and staff are at a stage of just They have been working at the coalface endlessly for years and years and years with no rest, no remit from it, and they are just tired.
They're tired, and the patients, if you are sitting on a waiting list for that length of time, that can have huge consequences.
It can, and I'm very interested in listening to your previous piece there about obesity and weight. Can you imagine that if you are sitting on a waiting list, waiting for perhaps a knee replacement, hip replacement, and your ability to do any exercise is very limited by that, but you're sitting on that waiting list for years, maybe 4 or 5 years, obviously you're going to increase your weight. Increasing your weight, you're going to potentially develop diabetes. These are the problems that we are saving up by keeping people on waiting lists for longer and longer.
And it's getting into, to be able to address this, it's getting into the whys of it. And there are so many elements of this. I know that COVID, I'm sure, has a role to play, staff shortages. How can this be tackled? Because looking at some of these figures and what you're saying, describing it as not just a red flag, an SOS, time is of the essence here.
Time is absolutely of the essence, and we've been talking about this, as have other sectors within the healthcare service, been talking about it for quite some time. We really are at a crossroads where we have to have those decisions made of how we are going to tackle waiting lists, how we are going to manage our health service going forward, and how we are going to improve the health of the nation. I think now that we have Stormont back, we have a health minister in place, I think now is the time that we can start to come up with the answers and implement those for the better of the people.
What conversations are you having then with Robin Swan? What's the response? I mean, because sometimes we do hear carefully worded statements and that, you know, something is going to happen. Did you get a sense that something will, that this will be addressed urgently?
I think certainly from the Health Committee it will be. We found the Minister to be very engaging with us over the years. We found the Minister being very engaging during COVID as well. We were very pleased to see him back in the role as Health Minister. But we've got to accept that this is a monumental task before us, and this will take all stakeholders to get their shoulder to the wheel and move this forward.
So what's the priority then? If you're having these conversations with Robin Swan, what are you saying? What this needs to happen now to save lives?
I think the first thing that we would have to do is look at our workforce, stabilise our workforce, fill the gaps, and ensure that we have the right number of people in the right places to deliver the right care to patients.
And in terms of a timescale, it's hard not to, and we do it an awful lot, but you can't not make the comparisons to England, for example, and our figures are so much worse. So this has to be at the top of a list. Have you got a timescale in mind? Are you looking down the road and thinking, if nothing is done by the end of this year, we're in big trouble here?
Well, we were listening to our colleagues in the Royal College of General Practitioners. They were very clear. If something is not done urgently within the next 18 months, general practice in Northern Ireland will collapse. So if you want a timescale, there's a perfect one. They're saying that their service can only last another 18 months at present.
18 months before it will collapse?
Yes.
And what does that look like? What does that mean for patients?
What it means is we already see patients, you know, being frustrated at the fact that they struggle to get a GP appointment. We're seeing in the last year, 18 general practice is handing back their contract to the Department of Health. It will become increasingly difficult for people to get access to primary care. And you've got to realise that a lot of those primary care episodes feed into secondary care, which is to myself as a surgeon or to other services within hospitals. So if you lose the sort of the front door, you're going to have major problems.
Niall McGonigal, the Director of the Royal College of Surgeons in Northern Ireland, thank you for your time on that this morning. Thank you to you at home as well for getting in touch with all your texts and all your calls. In fact, over the past 2.5 weeks, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you to our guests and commentators, particularly our Marie Curie nurse, Laura, and to Lisa, who shared her story at the start of this programme. A huge reaction to that, so thank you. Stephen will be back here on Monday. He'll be raring to go, won't he? Thanks for being brilliant. Have a great weekend. Connor is next.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Ich bin Lea.
Ich bin Lina und wir machen den Podcast Juice.
Das hier ist Juice und da erzählen wir uns gegenseitig jede Woche eine juicy Geschichte aus der Community. Egal, ob die jetzt schockierend, peinlich oder einfach nur funny ist.
Zum Beispiel die Geschichte über Raphael, der eine Hodenkrankheit vortäuscht, nur um sein Date im Krankenhaus zu besuchen.
Die Ärztin so, naja, können wir den Hoden auch antackern.
Hört Juice überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Wir freuen uns. It's spicy, you tell me, yeah.